Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be marking the Feast of the Ascension with a musical comment on the second glorious mystery of the Rosary. I'll be shining the spotlight on communications, focusing on both old and new. And I'll be taking you with me and indeed our popular Latin lover to Alexandria before Gutenberg. But first of all, the latest from the Vatican, beginning with a report on Pope Benedict's words to Cuban bishops in Rome this past week on their ad limina visit. Chris Altieri reports.
Since the 1986 Cuban National Church gathering, and especially since the visit of Pope John Paul II a decade ago, the church in Cuba has begun to experience a renaissance, with a notable increase in vocations to the priesthood and to religious life. Speaking to the bishops on Friday morning, the Holy Father said he is well aware of the vitality of the church in Cuba, and that Cuban ecclesial life has experienced a profound change as a result of the meeting and the visit of Pope John Paul II. The Holy Father said the church in Cuba has been intensely involved in pastoral work that has strengthened the missionary spirit of all the Cuban ecclesial communities. The Pope invited the bishops to continue with an audacious and generous effort towards evangelization, bringing the light of Christ to every place and all areas of life, and expressed the hope that the church in Cuba could have a normal access to the media. Pope Benedict told the bishops, "In this moment of history, the church in Cuba is called to offer to the whole of Cuban society the one true hope, Christ our Lord, who is victor over sin and death." This, said Pope Benedict, is the strength that has kept the faithful of Cuba firmly on the path of faith and love. Pope Benedict also spoke of the need to form the laity in the faith, to promote marriage, and to protect the family. I'm Chris Altieri.
Also on Friday in Vatican-related news was a conference which took place at the Pontifical University Regina Apostolorum in Rome. Lydia O'Kane reports.
The forum, sponsored by the embassies of the United States, the Republic of Costa Rica, and Chile to the Holy See, brought together diplomats and experts to discuss challenges to human rights. We spoke with United States Ambassador to the Holy See, Marianne Glendon, about the importance of a conference like this.
Who knows what effect can come from a conference here, a UN speech there, but if you have enough of this sort of resourcement, reappropriation, new initiative, things can change. That's the faith on which the United Nations was explicitly founded. One word they use over and over again in their charter is faith. Faith in human dignity, faith in human rights.
And on Saturday in the Vatican itself, Pope Benedict also received in audience the participants at the 14th plenary session of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. Lydia O'Kane again.
Gathered in the consistory hall, the participants listened as Pope Benedict began by focusing on the theme they had chosen for this plenary assembly.
In choosing the theme, pursuing the common good, how solidarity and subsidiarity can work together, you have decided to examine the interrelationships between four fundamental principles of Catholic social teaching: the dignity of the human person, the common good, subsidiarity, and solidarity. These key realities, which emerge from the living contact between the gospel and concrete social circumstances, offer a framework for viewing and addressing the imperatives facing mankind at the dawn of the 21st century, such as reducing inequalities in the distribution of goods, expanding opportunities for education, fostering sustainable growth and development, and protecting the environment.
The Pope then posed a question, asking how can solidarity and subsidiarity work together in the pursuit of the common good in a way that not only respects human dignity, but allows it to flourish, adding that this was at the heart of the matter which concerned them.
As your preliminary discussions have already revealed, a satisfactory answer can only surface after careful examination of the meaning of the terms.
The Holy Father then went on to talk about these dominant themes in terms of the human family.
The solidarity that binds the human family and the subsidiary levels reinforcing it from within must, however, always be placed within the horizon of the mysterious life of the triune God, in whom we perceive an ineffable love shared by equal, so nonetheless distinct persons.
Looking at solidarity and subsidiarity, Pope Benedict put the two themes in the context of the Gospel.
When we examine the principles of solidarity and subsidiarity in the light of the Gospel, we realize that they are not simply horizontal. They both have an essentially vertical dimension. Jesus commands us to do unto others as we would have them to do unto us, to love our neighbor as ourselves.
A society that honors subsidiarity, the Pope said, was one of liberation.
A society that honors the principle of subsidiarity liberates people from a sense of despondency and hopelessness, granting them the freedom to engage with one another in the spheres of commerce, politics and culture.
In conclusion, the Holy Father said that in revealing the Father's love, Jesus has taught us not only how to live as brothers and sisters here on earth, he has shown us that he himself is the way to perfect communion with one another. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
And a big thank you there to Lydia O'Kane, who's got a busy weekend. As on Saturday evening, she'll be doing a live commentary on Pope Benedict's visit to the Basilica of St. Mary Major, where he's scheduled to lead the faithful in the recitation of the Rosary at the beginning of this Marian month of May. That's why I too have chosen to bring you a musical comment on one of the mysteries of the Rosary, the second glorious mystery. Stay tuned as we join Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Chelos ascendit hodie. Today he ascended into heaven. That uplifting motet for double choir is by Sir Charles Villiers Stanford, a composer little known outside the Anglo-Saxon world, but a towering figure in late Victorian England nevertheless. An Irishman by birth, he became Professor of Music at Cambridge, and he taught for many years at the Royal College of Music in London. As a Protestant, he didn't often have occasion to write Latin motets, but this piece wasn't actually written to be sung in church. It was grace before meals at an Ascension Day banquet in Trinity College, Cambridge. What a marvellous way to begin a festal meal. Chelos ascendit hodie was later published as one of three Latin motets by Stanford, all written in similar circumstances, and now in the repertoire of cathedral choirs. Many of the anthems and motets written for the Feast of the Ascension draw on the text of Psalm 47, O clap your hands. That's because verses 5 and 6 seem particularly appropriate. That was taken from a setting by Orlando Gibbons, who was organist of the Chapel Royal in London in the early 17th century. Now let's listen to a setting of the same words in Latin, written by a contemporary of Gibbons, the composer Peter Phillips, who, like so many English Catholics, had fled to the continent to escape persecution.
O shame,
As you can imagine, there's no shortage of fine choral music to celebrate the feast of the Lord's Ascension. But I'd like to move on now to consider a remarkable piece of 20th century organ music, written as an extended meditation on this same mystery. L'Ascension by Olivier Messiaen was originally written for orchestra in 1933, but transcribed for organ the following year. The third movement, which we're going to hear now, was added in the organ version. It's called Transport de Joie, Joyful Cries of a Soul Beholding the Glory of Christ, which is also its own. Messiaen was a church organist himself at La Trinité in Paris for over 60 years. The French have a fine tradition of liturgical organ music and especially improvisation. It must have been wonderful to hear Messiaen improvising there Sunday after Sunday. The final movement of L'Ascension is called Prière du Christ montant vers son Père, Prayer of Christ ascending towards the Father. Messiaen bases it on a text from St. John's Gospel. Father, I have made your name known to them. Now I am not in the world any longer, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. Slowly and calmly, the music rises, caught up in rapturous contemplation of this timeless mystery.
Our thanks go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And now I'll shine the spotlight on communications. As you know, Sunday, 4th of May, marks the 42nd World Communications Day. And back in January this year, Benedict XVI issued a message for this particular celebration in a document which highlights how the media is today at a crossroads between self-promotion and service, and should encourage us in our search for the truth in order that we share it with others. Pope Benedict, as we know, has often spoken of the role of the media, and on other occasions he's been particularly encouraging. For example, in the first year of his pontificate in August 2005, while being interviewed by journalists, he remarked how Christianity and Catholicism should not just be a collection of prohibitions, but a positive option. An idea reflected in the theme of a seminar which took place at the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross here in Rome this past week, which was Church Communication and the Culture of Controversy. Words which imply how church organizations should better communicate in the public arena about the activities and identity of the Catholic Church. The seminar was attended by Liam Kelly, Communications Director at the Benedictine Abbey of Ampleforth in Yorkshire, England. Philippa Hitchin spoke to him about the aims of this conference, in particular about how the Church responds and deals with crisis and controversy.
One of the things that we see in the media today is how much they love controversy and conflict. They thrive on it. The Church has got to dialogue with the world, the culture today, and so it needs to study and reflect on how it actually deals with those controversies. You can't just say, no comment and we want nothing to do with it. You have to dialogue with that world, that culture today, and it's a culture of controversy.
Particularly in Britain, we see that any news, bad news about the Church, any scandals, anything like that will generate news headlines. It's very hard to get a good news story about the Church, about religion in general, through into the media, isn't it?
One of the interesting things that has already come out of the conference is a statement, in fact, that I think Joaquin Navarro-Valls said some time ago, that if the Church's message creates controversy, it shows that the message has actually had an impact. And so there's the positive side of controversy as well. So the Church must also learn how to deal with that positive side, to make that positive impact and be proactive rather than just being reactive and trying to wash its hands of that culture of controversy.
This is a slow process for the Church, isn't it, which, as you say, in the past has tended to simply try and keep away from contact with the media?
I think it's almost learning a new language. The Church speaks one language, the media speaks another. That's often the message that is put across. I've heard of bishops who say, yes, we deal with communications because you can read in the newspaper about the times of our services. Actually, the media speaks a different language. The Church needs to learn that language.
This is an ambitious conference, isn't it? Because you're dealing with countries and churches across the globe, and of course every country will have its own approach, which may differ considerably from other countries.
I think that's also one of the enriching things about the conference. Apparently there are 55 nations represented. While that does present a very practical logistical problem, language, it also means that particularly in the breaks, etc., there's a great exchange going on.
You were listening there to Liam Kelly, Communications Director at the Benedictine Abbey of Ampleforth in England, speaking to Philippa Hitchin about the Catholic Church and the culture of controversy. I couldn't help but think what a far cry it was from those first timid days in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, when the Church began paving the way in the field of communications. But if you're curious to know more, just join me as I step back in time, looking at this area of interest in the days, well, first of all, of Pope Paul VI. But do watch the change of pace and tone as I delve into our own Vatican Radio archives. The date was December the 4th, 1963, and in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, the Council Fathers passed a decree focusing on the role of the Church in the field of communications, a role the Pope at the time was all too aware of. He was Pope Paul VI, and as we're about to hear, a dab hand at using radio, despite still using the royal plural.
On the radio, we, as your new Holy Father, have this pleasure for the first time. It is a source of joy and happiness for us to be able to speak to you in your own homes and schools, or wherever you are gathered to listen.
Three decades later, another pope spoke to the members and staff of a pontifical council dedicated to social communications. An establishment which may have gone back to preconciliar times in an experimental form, but one he himself had only officially established 3 years earlier. You may have guessed, he's Pope John Paul II, and he too spoke in English.
The Church's presence in the media is especially necessary in order to ensure that the gospel message is integrated into the new culture being created by modern communications.
It was 1991, and Pope John Paul was speaking to the members and staff of this pontifical council about this decree focusing on the media. Its title in Latin is Intermirifica. Translated into English, it has a sound filled with promise. Among the wonderful things. A promise reminiscent of that role of the Church as a pioneer in communications, long before the document was ever written. As the former president of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, Cardinal John Foley, who owed his job to this document, remarked once to me.
The Church was the first to use the print medium through the Gutenberg Bible. It was one of the pioneers in radio through Vatican Radio, established by Marconi himself.
In the tiny Vatican State, from a great radio station built by Marconi, the Pope, for the first time in 1900 years of Catholicism, has sent his voice throughout the world.
And it was one of the pioneers in the use of satellite television in transmitting papal ceremonies over the world. But in the context of the Second Vatican Council, the Council Fathers realized both the opportunities and the difficulties in communications and wanted to address both.
And this new course, spearheaded by the Council Fathers for the use of future generations, was for a fast-changing world where the use of the media was indeed beginning to take on sometimes threatening contours, as mirrored in the introduction of Inter Mirifica.
Mother Church, to be sure, recognizes that if these instruments are rightly used, they bring solid nourishment to the human race. But the Church is also aware that people can employ these gifts against the mind of the divine benefactor and abuse them to their own undoing. In fact, the Church grieves with a motherly sorrow at the damage far too often inflicted on society by the perverse use of these media.
In those days, this document seemed revolutionary. Not only did it mark the very first time that a general council of the Church addressed itself to the problem of communications, but it was also the first general mandate of the Church to the clergy and the laity on the use of the media. And as Pope John Paul pointed out, it provided a practical guide of sorts.
Offered guidelines that are of great value for society. The changes in technology and indeed in society include the fact that the media now make it possible for people everywhere to witness events as they occur. Nevertheless, the way in which events are perceived often depends on the views of those who control the flow of information and possess the technical means to broadcast it.
As Pope John Paul pointed out a decade ago, immediacy and advanced technology require safeguards. And a later document, sometimes referred to as Inter Mirifica's Child, provided these guidelines. Cardinal John Foley again.
I think a major fruit of it was the publication of the pastoral instruction on the communications media, Communio et Progressio, Communion and Progress. And as a result of the two documents in tandem, you've had the establishment of communications, commissions, or councils on the national level throughout the world, on the continental level, and also communications offices in almost every diocese in the world.
But almost half a century ago, Inter Mirifica itself spelt out the Church's idea of what the media was all about for the first time in history.
Decreta que in ac sacrosanta et universalis synodo Vaticana II, legitime congregata, modo lecta sua.
Well, Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to this exclusive sound from our Vatican Radio archives. And finally, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who today rather fittingly speaks to us of another form of communication. Stay tuned.
I've always wondered, did the Romans like reading? Did they treasure books? Did the emperors try and create libraries? And what kind of a record do we have of all this? Do we have any knowledge of all this at all?
It's very interesting. I'm reading a book right now about libraries in the ancient world and what the emperors tried to do and build public libraries and all that. But he said, we have the information we simply don't have. Mm. Sad to say.
How'd you say library in...
Biblioteca.
Biblioteca? So we've lost...
A lot of the details and how they got books and... Certain Alexandria, we know the whole history. Pergamum, we know the history of some of these big libraries that, you know, the Eastern emperors or monarchs had, and they're all described. Who was in charge for 50 years, 20 years, 40 years, etc., etc. But personal libraries, how people got books, and Cicero says, copy this book. Where do they get a copy of this thing? At a bookseller, downtown, someone else? We just don't know a lot of things. After a while, they had booksellers. You could go down to the forum and buy books. But for ages, hundreds of years, they didn't have anything like that. You'd have to go to some educated man and say, do you have this author, Homer, or someone in your library? The scrolls, you know, and then they would look and yes, no. Our history, Roman history, is very weak, which is true, because it was half destroyed by the Gauls in 390. So all that preceded 390 BC was practically destroyed. To think that Mark Anthony, gave Cleopatra, as the Eastern monarch, 200,000 scrolls from the Library of Pergamum up in Asia Minor. For her library in Alexandria, which was the gem of the world.
Mm. Mm. How would you say that? In
what? Life? What?
Mark Antony gave her...
Ducenta milia codicum.
Codicum is a word for book.
Codex, you know.
Codex.
Codex, you know, the scrolls. Or voluminum. A Cleopatra donavit. Nescio ut munus beneficium quodam as a gift. In Alexandria, there were 400, they say... 490,000 scrolls in the Library of Alexandria. Whole history of the world, omnia perierunt. All these things have been lost somewhere.
And heartfelt thanks there once again to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.